working in corrections, I heard the same frustration, that political rhetoric not only floods their facilities, but robs them of the resources they need to do their jobs.
People want to lock people up and keep them locked away, and then when their sentence is over, they expect this person to be reformed or a different person. And if you haven't given them any skills or trained them, you know, how can they be?
I'm the cabinet making instructor here at Lexington Votech. When these guys get out of prison, we find them a job and help them get a job, keeps them working, makes them taxpayers of the state of Oklahoma.
He's already got one strike against him that he's convicted felon, but at least he can say, hey, I'm a licensed electrician or a licensed carpenter.
For a lot of these guys, they've never had self-respect, I guess. I mean, it's been false self-respect because they were tough or because they stole a lot or because they sold a lot of drugs. And this gives them the chance to anchor themselves to something good, these rehabilitation programs.
Prison's not a nice place, but I'm glad I came here. It's made me a better person. This program's probably the best thing that happened to me in my life.
We are seeking change, accepting that we cannot change our past, but we can change our future.
The problem is, when you get into lean budget times, the public, the citizens of Oklahoma, say, if we have to spend money on something, let's spend money on fences, handcuffs, cell doors, that kind of stuff. The rehabilitation programs are often the first thing that get cut.
If we don't have the resources available, that equates to not being able to give an offender a trade or a skill, and they end up going right back to the same deviant behavior on the outside.
If I didn't care more than words can say, if I didn't care.
I'm Larry Curley. I'm the marshal here in Magdalena. Magdalena is a small spot in the world. We're about 250 miles from the Mexican border. We have U.S. Highway 60. It's a main corridor for drugs.
I need your driver's license, please, your insurance.
For the last 29 years in working in law enforcement, the major thing that's changed is the drug trafficking.
What are you looking for, the drug guys?
Anything.
Everything.
At first glance, Marshall Curley seemed from a bygone era of law enforcement.
I guess I'm going to portray myself as that kind of person. A man with a white hat, riding old silver.
But as enforcing drug laws has become the primary focus for police across the country, the nature of his work as a small-town marshal has changed as well.
You got that?
Why?
Two Hispanic males in a car, dark tinted windows. We want it on that side of the road.
Yeah.
Okay. What are you going to tell her? She knows you're going to jail. You can go ahead and put him in the car.
Okay, if I check in there a little bit more?
So he's got some marijuana there.
Dad, you arrest both these people and tow this car? That's what we're going to do.
We're fishing. We're fishing, but we're there again. You look at trucks like this truck here, that's an Arizona truck. Somebody that's not going to stop and get a motel room. Somebody that's been driving for 24 hours because they don't want to get caught. This is telling me that this person right here could be a drug trafficker.
Because what's he doing that's giving you that impression?
The truck and fast food. We're not supposed to, it's supposed to be illegal to profile.
Right.
But you kind of, after working so long, you kind of know. Who's doing something?
So is it sort of phony when people say they don't profile? Is it sort of?
Oh, that's all phony. That's all phony. If you don't profile vehicles, you're not in law enforcement. That's the way it is, man. You know? Come on.
Okay, now what about profiling people?
Profiling people, same thing. What's it? Yeah.
We like to believe that the drug war has given law enforcement all these tools, all of this authority in which to pursue criminality and gangsterism. But actually what it did was, it basically destroyed the police deterrent in a very subtle and unintended way.
Going up to 15th Street in Dixie, he's gonna have some crack for him and some oxycodone pills.
Joe and I are both sergeants in major narcotics, and we don't do street level drug deals. We do, you know, larger quantity cases. We're looking for the dealers and the suppliers.
Okay, deal is good.
Guys, move in.
A world away from Magdalena in the streets of Miami, I began to see the real impact of the drug war on law enforcement.
Start thinking about why you're in handcuffs, and maybe you can help yourself out, okay?
So what happened is that the second guy, he's now running on foot. Yeah, that's where we believe he might have gone in there.
I guess we're going to have to write this up as a separate case.
Totally unrelated to the original drug deal we did, but we stumble upon a house where a couple of big stacks of money, a good amount of marijuana. That's sometimes how things happen. You know, they're not even planned.
Nobody respects good police work more than me. I spent more than a decade covering it, and there are a lot of detectives who I admire for their professionalism, for their craft.
Hey, what's up? Can I help you?
No, no, sir.
The drug war created an environment in which none of that was rewarded.
Come on over here for a second. Let's get his ID. He's just cutting through the yard.
A drug arrest does not require anything other than getting out of your radio car and jacking people up against the side of a liquor store. Probable cause? Are you kidding?
I don't want to say a majority of the people, but there's a good number of people probably in this area that are also involved in drug dealing.
The problem is there's a real tendency on the part of law enforcement to think geographically, to go throw resources at an area. It's fish in a barrel for law enforcement. Anytime you need to make an arrest, you troll through there. Everybody committing crimes in that area gets arrested. People who are in the area who aren't committing crimes get stopped. It makes everybody angry.
Watching arrest after arrest, I began to see for the first time the destructive impact of drug laws not only on those they target, but on those who enforce them as well.
The problem is that cop that made that cheap drug arrest, he's going to get paid. He's going to get the hours of overtime for taking the drugs down to ECU. He's going to get paid for processing the prisoner down at Central Booking. He's going to get paid for sitting back at his desk and writing the paperwork for a couple hours. And he's going to do that 40, 50, 60 times a month so that his base pay might end up being only half of what he's actually paid as a police officer.
Most important thing right here.
We're paying a guy for stats.
You can leave them here and then we can go back out and do this other deal.
Compare that guy to the one guy doing police work, solving a murder, a rape, a robbery, a burglary. If he gets lucky, he makes one arrest for the month. He gets one slip signed. And at the end of the month, when they look and they see, Officer A, he made 60 arrests. Officer B made one arrest. Who do you think they make the sergeant?
Hey, let's move in, guys, move in.
In a city like, say, Baltimore, where I'm from, our percentage of arrest for murder, for rape and robbery, are half of what they once were. Our drug arrest stats are twice of what they once were.
So what does that do?
It makes a city unlivable. It makes a police department where nobody can solve a crime.
Beyond the incentives that exist for individual officers, it turns out that whole departments have a monetary interest in increased drug arrests.
Most people don't realize that the financial incentives built into the system virtually guarantee that the overwhelming majority of drug arrests in the United States will be for nonviolent, low-level drug offenses.
A couple months ago, we did a two-day operation. We arrested over 200 people, a majority of them for selling drugs. A lot of the money comes out of seizures from the drug profits that the bigger players are making off of this. So I guess that money is being put to good use.
So where you get all that money?
All right.
That money's ours now. That's my money now.
If I leave this room and I go out there and get my old truck, and I drive down the highway with $5,000 cash in my pocket that I earn, and if I'm pulled over by a state trooper who says, oh, you have a defective taillight or something, they can take that $5,000, never charge me with a crime, take my old truck to boot, keep them forever. It's called RICO, civil asset seizure. It goes on every day in counties all over this country.
Hey, can we get somebody get a tow slip for this fine piece of machinery?
Yeah, see, like it's $118,000 I pulled over right here and we comped the rest of the guy. With the $25,000 I got out of that seizure, that's what we bought this car for.
Okay, so wait a second. So the police department operates on the money it seizes?
Sometimes.
This is legal within the state of New Mexico.
It's allegedly legal.
No, it is legal. You're not getting the point.
No,
everything.
I am getting the point. Probable cause.
What happens is, with every successive encounter between one of our drug warriors and a citizen that goes awry,
the people are out here minding their own business.
Respect for cops and the laws they're trying to enforce is lost.
The guy was upset because he's saying that we were stopping him illegally. It was unconstitutional. He feels like he's been violated. Is that fair? Maybe not. But I have a job to do.
Despite their commitment to their work, officers I spoke to across the country expressed growing concern not only about the effectiveness of drug laws, but about their larger impact on the relationship between police and the public.
It's one of the biggest hurdles, you know, how much time the community has spent feeling like they couldn't trust the police.
In Providence, officers who 20 years ago appeared on TV as the picture of tough-on-crime cops,
7-1's got tinted windows,
today seem conflicted over how things got where they are and what a better approach might look like.
If you're going to go out there and go and cause chaos, might as well put you in a structured program. And the military is a structured program. Send them to a boot camp, see how they make out in the boot camp.
National service.
National service, something.
I mean, we're doing our part out here, and it's frustrating a lot for us because it just seems like
because they're addicts, they find themselves committing the same crime that just put them in the jail, say, you know, a week or so prior.
Hold on a second.
All right, whoa.
What's going on? Let me see your ID, please. Let me see your ID.
My ID?
Come on, you get some responsibilities. You're going to go with the parents. Listen, you're treating your kid out.
Well, that's easier said than done when you have absentee parents.
Why are you motherfucking
relax, man? Relax.
Some of these households, the father is non-existent. The mother is trying to raise a family. Those kids, the percentage of kids that break out of that is really low.
Please, it's not me.
I'll tell you what else bothers me.
Hang around all the time, huh?
If you keep having kids and you can't afford them, you know what? You have a certain responsibility. I'm not saying to freaking control or spade them, but Christ. Neutered them, you know? But come on. Jesus. What they should do, I'd pay them like $5,000 or $10,000 to get like a vasectomy or something. It's cheaper in the long run. Why are you laughing, Pat?
And you're listening to The House I Live In? And this is an expanded Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. And we will be here for another 45 minutes. The house I live in, while recognizing the seriousness of drug abuse as a matter of public health, it investigates the tragic errors and shortcomings that have meant that it is more often treated as a matter of law enforcement, creating a vast machine that feeds largely on America's poor and especially on minority communities. Beyond simple misguided policy, the house I live in examines how political and economic corruption have fueled the war for 40 years despite persistent evidence of its moral, economic, and practical failures. We are making this film available to you this evening as a way of saying thank you for your material commitment to this station. You can love the program and you can love this station, but you have to support it because when we love things, we do operate in a historic and a contemporary context, and it means sustaining things we love materially. So we are asking you to go to your telephone this evening, 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, and for a $75 pledge, 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602.
It has to do with targeting a certain population, the African American population. It is succeeding on the basis on which it was formed, as a program to get votes for the Republican and then the Democratic Party. It has nothing to do with crime. It has nothing to do with drugs. It is a target electoral approach. 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. Go to your phone right now to support this station, which will highlight the house I live in, which is about the United States, the house that we live in, and the disparities and the crimes of the state and of the politicians within this country. 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, to stop concentrating on false issues and start talking about the mass unemployment in this country, to talk about the infrastructure which is falling by the roadside as we build prisons to incarcerate people. 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, because we need to understand what is going on. We need to understand the history of what has been going on. We need to get the house I live in, view this film, listen to the film, see the film, share the film, and talk about what are the priorities of this country at the present time. Look at it historically and say, where do we go from here? 516-620-3602. And support WBAI, which asks these questions 24/7, which support WBAI's Building Bridges, which talks about unemployment, which talks about unionization and deunionization, what we must fight. 516-620-3602, which understands that we need to turn this country around and end the war on drugs. 516-620-3602. Go to your phone right now. Get the house I live in, $75 pledge, and you'll get this gift from the station. It is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. It really raises some issues that you need to deal with. Mimi?
Well, the house I live in is not what, you know, some people, you know, if we were listening to a Bill O'Reilly or somebody might think of as a lefty rant about the personal liberty from some camera-wielding California dreamer who wants to be able to smoke more weed. This is a film that is about social justice, or perhaps I should say really more to the point, social injustice, and how American drug laws seem designed to keep certain segments of the population marginalized. And by certain sectors of the population, I mean people of African ancestry. I mean Latino people. I mean poor people. I mean, more specifically and totally, the people of lower socioeconomic backgrounds for whom the American dream seems just that, a dream, nothing tangible or attainable or the slightest bit real. It would be one thing if it was draconian and it worked, some might say, but it's draconian and it doesn't work. It just lends to more incarceration, more containment, and it covers up the reality, really, of America's drug epidemic. The house I live in is filled with arguments and meaningful discourse from credible voices, from criminal justice experts, to addiction experts, to law enforcement officers who speak on the issue. And despite their disparate backgrounds, nearly every one of them seems to agree that the system as we know it is not operating as it was intended. One of the most strategic problems of our communities, let's get with it. Let's do the organizing. We have over 2 million people in our jails. We have overwhelmingly people of color in our jails. Overwhelmingly, this is as a result of the so-called war on drugs, but it's a war on particular communities, not on drug use and abuse, which is fundamentally a health-based issue. This film is profound, and it's enraging, and it's potentially galvanizing, and it's one of the most important pieces of nonfiction to hit the screen in years. 516-620-3602. That number, 515-1662-3602 because we have a social responsibility to continue to keep this media giant that is unflinching in its critique of the system, that is not merely a critic, but provokes people to action and indeed puts forward people who are the activists to stimulate others in an organizing effort for real social change within this incredibly corrupt society that is the destroyer in a myriad of ways of people's lives. Whether one wants to look at the growth of poverty and the economic desperation that people are experiencing in the labor market, whether one wants to look at what has happened in our environment and the decimation of the ecological balance of our planet, if one wants to engage and look at the deterioration of civil rights and civil liberties, which, good gracious, in the past weeks, from the Supreme Court's unraveling and decimation in its decision that essentially gutted the Voting Rights Act, to what has happened to the hundreds of thousands of youth in New York with the policies of stop and frisk that seek to criminalize entire communities of predominantly African American and Latino youth, whether it is the vicious legal lynching, which was the reality of the verdict, finding not guilty George Zimmerman for the murder of young Trayvon Martin. That's what this station, that's what WBAI's Building Bridges talks about unflinchingly and offers another perspective and sensitivity so that we can mobilize to correct the myriad injustices. And frankly, there's so much that is encompassed in the war on drugs as a way of removing entire blocks of people from their communities, African American people, Latino people, poor people. 516-620-3602. I'm going to give you that number one more time. $75 pledge for BAI, for Building Bridges, for yourself, and for this outstanding award-winning film, which you will listen to again and again and use as a mobilizer and an organizer for yourself to deepen your information on this critical issue and to bring people together to fight against this horrible system of incarceration and the resultant new Jim Crow. 516-620-3602. And we are going to return now to the house I live in.
Watching seasoned drug warriors struggle for answers to what they see as an unwinnable war.
We're actually doing them a favor, tell them, getting them in out of the cold.
I wondered what it was about drugs that made them such a perceived danger in the first place.
You have to understand the war on drugs has never been about drugs.
U.S. customs officers and police are having another drive to round up dope smugglers. Here's millions of dollars worth of deadly heroin, enough, they say, to kill 6 million people.
Looking to find out more about the longer history of drugs in America, I found an unlikely source in Lincoln historian Richard Miller. His research put drug laws in a fascinating historical context.
Historically, anti-drug laws have always been associated with race. In the 1800s, certain kinds of drugs that are illicit today were common in this country. Cocaine was widely used, heroin. People using drugs was something that was just ordinarily accepted. Opium, for example, was used by middle-aged, successful whites, often housewives in the South. If people were addicted or abusing drugs, they were viewed sympathetically as people who had to be helped. It was seen as a public health issue rather than a crime issue. Well, one of the first changes was on the West Coast when smoking opium was made a criminal offense. Now, why would opium smoking be illegal in California but not in Mississippi? What was going on in California that was a concern about smoking opium? Well, as it turns out, it had nothing to do with opium itself. The concern was with the people associated with smoking opium, and that was the Chinese who had come to this country, and many of whom were in California, working hard, working for very little pay, and becoming part of the American success story. But their success was taking jobs away from white workers. So politicians got together and decided they got to find something about the Chinese for which they can be criminalized to get them out of the way. Now, of course, you can't throw people in jail simply because they're Chinese, but you can throw them in jail because they smoke opium. In the same way, we saw things going on with cocaine. Again, it was middle-aged, successful people in this country, business executives, physicians, housewives, all perfectly legal. But then around the turn of the century, cocaine began being associated with blacks. They could withstand police bullets, it was thought. They can work hard all day, all night long, and all day long again, threatening the jobs of white workers. And so laws began to be passed against cocaine. You're not arresting these people officially because they're black. You're arresting them because they've committed some sort of drug violation. Next, of course, we see the change in reputation that hemp has had. Hemp was a legitimate crop from colonial times forward, a widely appreciated commercial product. But then in the 1930s, hemp changed into something vicious and fearsome called marijuana, because at that time, marijuana smoking was being associated with Mexicans, working hard, working cheap. And once again, what was being outlawed was not being Mexican, but just some habit associated with Mexicans. These laws set up a very dangerous precedent of racial control.
It seemed that time and again, drug laws targeted any immigrant group seen as a threat to the established economic order. But how then did black Americans, who came to this country over 200 years ago, become the primary target of drug laws in the modern era?
Well, the way to think about African American history in the 20th century is as an immigrant story. I mean, the transition from the rural to the urban, it's one of the great mass migrations in the history of the world.
When blacks came out of slavery, they were heavily concentrated in the South in farming type jobs. As industries were expanding in the North, blacks were recruited to come to work in factories. This gave rise to the great migration of blacks flowing into urban areas.
Before she came to work for my family, Nanny Jeter had joined the wave of black Americans who'd moved north during the Great Migration. She took me down to her childhood home in Southern Virginia.
We grew up rumbling through the woods with a beautiful outside life. The old Victoria would play and somebody would square dance, and it was a completely different world. I love life in the South.
Now, in that environment that seems so wonderful in the South, why did you ever decide you wanted to leave the South?
I left the South because I had to. Jim Crow, during that time, you couldn't, black people, if they was raped, they couldn't say they was raped. So you never heard of rape. Only the white lady got raped, but the black woman, I was innocent, but people didn't think I was innocent. No one knew I was leaving. I wanted to bring my children up different. North was the way out. I thought it would make a big difference.
Nanny had never spoken so openly about her past and what it was that had compelled her north. But as I learned more about her life, I began to see the deeper roots of the drug war for black American families like Nanny's.
Sadly, what many of these families came to find is that they had not really escaped Jim Crow at all, but found themselves in a new system of racial control, a new Jim Crow. Racially discriminatory laws across America ensured that poor people of color migrating from the South would be confined to certain parts of the city that we now think of as ghettos.
Very few people know this, but if you go back and you look at how African-American housing patterns were established in the 30s and 40s, even as a result of the New Deal, The FHA, which was a Democratic New Deal program to inspire home ownership in the midst of the Depression, did more to create ghettos than any other federal program before or since. Why? Because when they were creating the culture of home ownership in America, they were exclusionary to black people. They put them in the areas that were maybe a little bit economically depressed and subject to heavy rentership. And then they redlined those areas and they would not write FHA mortgages in those neighborhoods. Once those areas were redlined, that was basically a design for a ghetto.
In 1950, people in these neighborhoods were poor, but they had jobs. By 1960, we're talking about the jobless poor, because industries had moved out of the inner city, leaving behind concentrated populations of poor people, vulnerable to drug trafficking and all of the other problems associated with joblessness.
And what happens when groups are denied access to the core economic engines in a society? They create their own out of prohibited economies. That was true of the Italians and the Irish and the Jews and everybody else who came to the cities a generation before African Americans arrived.
In 1969, during that time, I couldn't get a job. It was like all the doors were shut. When I came to work for your parents, I was happy just to have this job.
Do you remember the first time you saw me?
Mm-hmm. Yes. It was about 3 days old when your mom brought you home from the hospital. It was the first time I seen you. You were a beautiful baby that I fell in love with. You became my baby. I loved your family. I guess I never dreamt that you guys would ever leave New Haven.
I've always known that when I was very young, my family's circumstances improved, and we moved from Connecticut, where my dad had been a doctor, to a comfortable suburb of New York City, where he'd started a successful business. What I didn't know was how this had impacted Nanny and her family.
Your mom, she said, my husband's going to double your pay if you can go with us. I felt more money would make a better life for my family. Eugene, that was the wrong thing to do. I was always working in New York whilst my kids were in New Haven. My youngest son, James, he started smoking marijuana at 14, and at 20, he started to really go into drugs. It is so amazing how you spend your life providing, loving your kids, that you don't see the mental part that's going on in their life. In turn, then you look at white kids, they have their parent and they have a housekeeper that loves them. But yet still, your kids are most of the time alone.
And what happened with James?
He got he died with AIDS from needles.
As Nanny and I returned to New Haven together, I suddenly saw my birthplace with new eyes, processing so much I hadn't understood about the intersection of James's life and my own. But what else had I missed? Growing up in the wake of the civil rights movement, I guess like many people, I imagined things were going to get better for black America. But as it turned out, in many ways, the worst was yet to come.
Growing up in Florida, I remember thinking that I never wanted to leave Florida.
I used to tell my friends, like, before we'd go out and do some illegal activity, I used to give them a pep talk and say, you know, God is on our side because he knows that we're poor, and God wouldn't have us be poor, so he understands what we're doing. And, you know, I actually believe that.
Carl Hart was part of a generation of black men who experienced firsthand the most dramatic escalation of the drug war in American history. Today, a professor of psychology at New York's Columbia University, his past experience remains a driving force in his work.
Growing up in the 1970s and 80s, many of my friends and family members got caught up in drug use. So I was always interested in drugs of abuse.
What I do today is that I actually give people drugs in the laboratory to study the effects of drugs like methamphetamine, cocaine, marijuana.
Though Carl's academic research is on the science behind addiction, his own experience has shown him how often drug laws are shaped less by scientific concerns than by political ones.
In the 1980s, like many people in the black community, I was concerned about the havoc that drugs were wreaking in our community, or the havoc that I thought drugs were wreaking in our community.
And that brings us to the major and sweeping effort that I'm announcing this morning.
In the long history of the drug war, no single chapter would turn out to impact black America more deeply than the 8 years of the Reagan presidency.
What will you do when someone offers you drugs?
While Nancy Reagan's popular slogan, "Just Say No," took what would seem a motherly approach to drug prevention, her husband took a far tougher approach.
We will have utilized the FBI, the DEA, the IRS, the ATF, Immigration and Naturalization Service, United States Marshals Services, and the Coast Guard. We intend to do what is necessary to end the drug menace and to eliminate this dark, evil enemy within.
When Reagan announced that he was planning to rev up the drug war, more than ever, it was political opportunity. Because at the time, drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. Less than 2% of the American population even identifies drugs as the nation's top priority. But then, of course, they got lucky.
Crack cocaine.
Crack, the super addictive and deadly cocaine concentrate.
Crack hit the streets, and suddenly there was just hysteria about this brand new demon-like form of cocaine.
Today, there's a new epidemic, smokable cocaine, otherwise known as crack. It is an uncontrolled fire.
Go, 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 go!
The American people want their government to get tough and to go on the offensive. And that's exactly what we intend, with more ferocity than ever before.
If smaller cities don't have a crack crisis now, they will soon.
What we saw were images of black urbanites on TV smoking crack cocaine over and over and over.
You could say incredible things about that drug and people will believe you.
Our society is now infested with drug abusers.
There was a tremendous fear of this epidemic that was going to overcome all of us, not only with drug addiction, but with the violence and terror that was going to come out of this. And tremendous fear led to this view that the criminal laws would save us.
Democrats as well as Republicans got on board to pass a whole new generation of mandatory sentencing laws. These laws raced through Congress in record time. There were virtually no hearings held, no consultation with experts who knew something about drug abuse.
The yeas are 97, the nays are 2.
This is something that had to be dealt with, and of course, you know, election year fever did take hold of some people.
With overwhelming support, Ronald Reagan signed into law an unprecedented array of mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes. But no drug would receive harsher penalties than crack.
The penalties were outrageous. That is, the penalty for crack cocaine was made 100 times more punitive than for powder cocaine.
Acceptance of coke is widespread, commonplace among professionals.
Whites were using powder cocaine in boardrooms in suburban America. Blacks were using crack cocaine in public housing and on the street. And what's the response?
Just wipe me out straight off the map for nothing. 57 years for some small rock, man. You know what I'm saying? I want to know why I'm being treated like I murdered somebody, you know?
Over time, as the number of blacks in America's prisons for drug crime skyrocketed, far outpacing the number of whites, many people, including many judges, began to question the disparity in sentencing between crack and powder.
And we are listening to another cut from The House I Live In. This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, and we have a few minutes more to urge you to pledge to WBAI to support this summer sizzling fund drive, which is our bread and butter that keeps us going and keeps people here who are paid working and keeps the station afloat. And this is your station. Whose station is it? It is your station. It picks up and brings forth the issues that are strategic and central to our workplaces, to our communities, to our lives. And this evening, we are focusing on and really engaged in a national call to conscience. Through this activist documentary, The House I Live In, which is so persuasively urgent. This is a movie that is insistently personal and political in its look at the war on drugs and its thousands of casualties, including those serving hard time for really minor offenses. And the filmmakers assert, as they sift through the data and they weigh the evidence and they check in with those on all sides, on both sides of the law, a war that has led to mass incarcerations characterized by profound racial disparities, and that has created another front in the civil rights movement. That is what our system of incarceration is, and that is what the war on drugs must become, really, another front in the civil rights movement. The title of the documentary isn't purely metaphor. The House I Live In, for starters, is the name of the song written by Lewis Allen and the blacklisted Earl Robinson. All races and all religions, that's America to me. That's become a part of the Paul Robeson songbook, right? That was sung. Even Frank Sinatra actually did the song in 1945 in a short film. And it is a plea for tolerance. And the filmmaker uses the Robeson version of the song in his final credits in the documentary. And it's a nod to the singer's really history of civil rights activism, because first and foremost, this is a civil rights film. 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, to get your own copy of this film as a thank you gift for $75 pledge to this hour of Building Bridges to this station, WBAI, for such an important and powerful work. The filmmakers ask, what's gone wrong? And the answer is drugs. But it's the manipulation of the issue of drugs and turning it into a criminal justice issue that becomes the answer. This is a film most essentially and most critically about race and class. 516-620-3602. We are here for just a limited period of time and trying to bring to you something that we think you will personally learn from and provides a really strategic tool to begin to organize around a subset of issues such as the new Jim Crow, which Michelle Alexander talks about, but the war on drugs as a precursor to that. 516-620-3602. The context for this war, which is really a war on the African American community, which is really a war on the Latino community, which is really a war on people who are poor, to begin to round them up and haul them off and warehouse them indefinitely in an ever more aggressive and torturous system of incarceration. I mean, just last week we covered on Building Bridges the hunger strike of 30,000 people in the Pelican Bay, California state prison system, where people are subject to from 10 to 28 years or really indefinite solitary confinement and how that breaks the human body and it breaks the human psyche, the ever-increasingly torturous prison system and the mechanisms for restraint and control that occur, indeed for torture, that take place within the walls. I know that you care about these things, and I know that we as groups of people of good conscience, and this is a call to that conscience, want to find more effective ways of organizing. And we want to organize against the war on drugs, against the war on drugs. And one way to do it is to take this film and have those strategic discussions. I promise you it will help tremendously. The war on drugs has been a failure practically. It's been a failure morally and economically. And the result of this law enforcement approach, which is stark, today there are more than 500,000 people incarcerated for drug offenses. Billions of dollars are spent annually on narcotics enforcement. Treatment is still out of reach for millions of people, and drugs are more available and cheaper than ever. But there's a growing recognition, and we have to be part of it, that the course of the past 40 years must change. And there is ever-increasing momentum, and we're part of it, for drug policy reform from all levels of government and civil society. Please call 516-620-3602 so you can take advantage of the $75 gift that we have, The War on Drugs, which is the film, The House We Live In, so that we can sharpen our resolve, enhance our information. This film breaks it down. In 2009, nearly 1.7 million people were arrested in the U.S. for nonviolent drug charges. More than half of those arrests were for marijuana possession alone. Less than 20% was for the sale or manufacture of a drug. Even though white and black people use drugs at approximately equal rates, black people are incarcerated 10.1 times more. They are more likely, 10 times more, to be sent to prison for drug offenses. How critical it is to pay attention to that. So this is the time. This is the moment. This is your vote against the war on drugs by calling up BAI 516-620-3602. Your $75 commitment, your material sustenance for the station. Say, I want The House I Live In, this remarkable, important piece of work, The House I Live In, this carefully woven documentary that attempts to explain why the land of the free currently has a higher percentage of its population behind bars than any other country. And it reports that the vast majority of those inside are there on drug-related charges. And since 1971, over $1 trillion has been spent on law, drug law, enforcement, prosecution, and incarceration. 516-620-3602. Get with it now. This is the time to call that call center, 516-620-3602. Get on that public conscience bandwagon, rail against, organize, and mobilize against the war on drugs, which is a war on our communities. It's a war on the poor. It's a war on people of African ancestry. It's a war on Latinos, to remove them from the body politic permanently.
516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. And now is the time for you to come to the aid of your station. Now is the time for you to preserve this station. And if you think this show is good, if you think that the focus of the station should be on these kinds of issues, issues of racism, issues of stop and frisk, issues that we've also dealt with on WBAI of unemployment, of deunionization of the country, on low-wage workers, on immigration. If you think that WBAI does and should continue to do that kind of job, go to your phone right now, get this wonderful documentary, The House I Live In, but most importantly, sustain this station so that a year from now, we'll still be here dealing with these crucial issues of our time. 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. The station is in trouble. The station needs your support. The station needs to sustain itself. And the way to do it right now is to go to your phone right now and get yourself a copy of this remarkable documentary, The House I Live In. Learn about what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow. Learn about racism in drug policy enforcement. Learn about the prison system. Learn about what you can do. Learn about how you can share this information. Go to your phone right now. Support yourself. Support WBAI. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. You'll be getting this documentary, which is certainly one of the best documentaries I've ever seen, not just on this subject, but on any subject. You'll want to keep it. You'll want to show it. And you'll want to support this station. 516-620-3602.
Mimi? This film about America's war on drugs shows a predictable pattern of human-wrought destruction seen throughout history and in all corners of the world. And the filmmakers have done a film on the war on drugs. And what it begins to do is it teaches people, really, to value people again who have been devalued. People who it has become easier to ignore and to pretend are responsible for their own suffering. And by easier, I mean that it becomes easier by design, I believe, for most people to take the path of least resistance and accept the propaganda than to make the really harder choices of questioning it and admittedly the really hard, ugly truths that would have to be faced if they start questioning too much. So besides the goal of finding a way to push back against the devaluation of other human beings, don't we first have to confront the problem of society perhaps not wanting to learn to value people again because of what they'd have to admit about themselves and the society as a whole? And as much as anything else, this is a film about that reality by looking at the war against people, particular communities, alleged to be a war on drugs. We are 2 minutes away from completing our segment on what we have called The House I Live In, or why indeed the war on drugs really has nothing to do with combating drugs. 516-620-3602. That is 516-620-3602, a $75 commitment to sustain a station that is unrelenting in its concern about race and class, that is committed and dedicated to building a new set of social relations, to tackling the issue of the distribution at wealth, which is the underpinnings of all that we have spoken about. So 516-620-3602, The House I Live In, will be what we give you as a way of saying thank you. Got to go. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Before you continue on with your day, I'd like to ask you to visit the website at wbai.org. and consider becoming a BAI buddy. For as little as $10 a month, you can help the station and make a recurring donation on behalf of this program. As a BAI buddy, you receive a WBI membership card, as well as very nice discounts at area museums and various local facilities, and selected WBI-supported events. And I'll donate a free CD, no charge to the station. It's a safe, secure, and easy way for you to support this 52-year-old commercial-free listener-sponsored radio station, WBAI.org. Thank you for your support.
On Sunday, August 4th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will present The Healer, Hammond B3 organist, Dr. Lonnie Smith. Join us as we do what we can to help continue this listener-supported experiment. That's Sunday, August 4th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
May my shred bestows the line of Heidi Nil and me sang. Dagger Headborn working, yen, our kid was in West China. Simon Calvin, Noddy Minor, Heidi Miller sang. No stinking buttons here, playing Cupid and Regina. I ain't writing no song to Inky, Heidi Miller sang. A pair of Stuart Rangers and a brought back the old timer. Schoolman T's, I clung inside a Heidi Miller sang. Miss Solar pointed red. Bog wrote songs in Asia Minor. Andy Lyons with Sailor Panther, Heidi Miller sang.
Forgive us for taking 6 minutes out of our Relentless Home Shopping Network method of fundraising for a bit of music to sort of catch us up to schedule, although we are actually an hour behind our scheduled schedule. This is WBAI New York. It's 1 a.m. You've heard a few tracks from the latest release by a band called Wire. Eels sang, and before that, Magic Bullet. In the background, Love Bends. But we have no time for music. It's a one canned fundraising show after another. And I do want to thank everyone for bearing with us during our summer fundraising effort. Now, we were supposed to be presenting to you a Robert Knight 5 o'clock shadow rebroadcast. It was supposed to begin an hour ago, but somehow... That edition of Building Bridges was only half done, and I figured rather than cut it off in the middle, we'd let it complete and move the schedule back an hour. Cut out something later. Like anyone's listening or cares. This is WBAI New York. We present next, though ordinarily you'd be listening to Earthwatch with Robert Knight, which should resume in a week or two once the fun drive has dragged to a halt. Please do consider, however, making a donation to the Transmitter Fund or the Moving Fund or the Building Fund, 516-620-3602. Yes, once we get past this fundraising patch, we can get back to some programming. But your help is always needed. And now we present Robert Knight in what would be the remainder, the last half hour of his Wednesday night... Thursday morning slot. Do stay tuned.
This is WBAI New York. And yes, we are still transmitting. And that means everything. And thank you for those of you who are today helping sustain our transmitter fund. We are in, what is this, the second day of the annual May fund drive, or marathon, as I prefer to call them. And
did I mention this is a rebroadcast?
Moment. And that special moment is rife with danger and ripe with opportunity. WBAI stands even closer now to its goal of having a permanent home. I don't know if I'm authorized to speak of details about which I'm only slightly aware, but I have reason to believe that within the next few months, we will have secured a new space. That means that we'll be rebuilding our own studios after our period of great courtesy and camaraderie and fraternity and sorority with our colleagues here at the City College at WHCR. Now, the issue is that we need money fast for urgent liquid requirements to be paid. I will simply say that the staff here at WBAI has been doing yeoman's duty under extraordinary difficult circumstances. And the troubles that we have gone through over the past year have been astounding and unique, I think, in broadcast. We were washed out of our studios at 120 Wall Street. We were not insurance compensated properly for the loss of income that being off the air there meant. We have entered into a binding agreement about our ability to sustain the most important transmitter in New York City at the Empire State Building. And so far, so good. But the ghosts of necessity haunt us. They breathe down our neck at this very moment. And I frankly hope that our presence here together today, along with the great work of everybody here involved with the staff and listeners of WBAI, will see the need to alacritously provide financial support. And in exchange for that, we are, as Kathy Davis was speaking earlier, we continue our focus on one of the most extraordinarily enlightening films and DVDs, yours for a pledge of $75, with a phone call to 516-620-3602. There are communities of consciousness all over this country. And WBAI and Pacifica, the network in general, is the cement between the bricks of isolated communities. And part of the mission of Pacifica is to bridge those gaps. And so we're bridging a philosophical and political and educational gap today with the author of this astonishingly insightful film called Ethos. It refers to character, and it attempts to do, in its way, what we attempt to do here at WBAI, and that is to stay focused on the central goodness of the human spirit, and to be able to hey, fellas, what's going on? Technical discussion here. Anyway, this is a special edition of 5 o'clock Shadow. My name is Robert Knight, and there are, we're customizing our studios here at WHCR, and naturally there's an ongoing amount of engineering, technical, electronic work going on, and some of that is happening right now, even as we speak. So that may be a signal that this would be a good time, Michael G. This might be a good time for people to hear a sample of the astute insight that is available for this offering of $75 for the film, Ethos. Please make that call now. I want to see that tally move. The day has been slow, and the need is great. So I'm counting on you to sustain the ethos that brought you to WBAI in the first place and requires its sustenance and survival. 516-620-3602. And here is a part of the film ethos that addresses the issue of finance, as it were.
Gold is valuable because it is relatively rare. Like gold, the value of money is determined by how much money is in circulation. One would think the power to regulate the money supply that controls our economy and affects our lives in every way would be in the hands of the government of the people. But surprisingly, it is not. The power to control the money supply is in the hands of the Federal Reserve Bank. It is important to note the Federal Reserve is not a government organization. It is a private banking cartel.
The Federal Reserve System is a banking cartel. It's no different than a banana cartel or an oil cartel or the sugar cartel. It just happens to be a banking cartel.
Congress, in essence, has ceded total control of the value of our money to a secretive central bank.
It's a group of very large and powerful private banking interests.
Congress knows nothing of the conversations, the plans, and the action taken in concert with other central banks.
The government has given it a monopoly, a virtual monopoly, to create the nation's money supply.
But all these actions directed by the Federal Reserve alter the purchasing power of our money. This has significant consequences on our economy and our political stability. Wages never keep up with profits on Wall Street and the banks, thus sowing the seeds of class and discontent.
It is bewildering to think that we allow an unelected and unregulated group of private bankers to wield such incredible influence over our society. The truth is that most of us will live from paycheck to paycheck in a continued state of struggle, unable to question a system of finance that keeps us on a constant treadmill. And while most of us struggle to stay ahead, billions of dollars in profits flow into the hands of private bankers at our expense. For this is how the system works. Whenever the government needs money, it requests it from the Federal Reserve. But the Fed doesn't just give the money to the government, it loans the money at interest. Every dollar the government loans from the Federal Reserve Bank has to be paid back with interest. This keeps the government, and as such the people, in a continual state of debt. All of our income taxes are paid back to the Federal Reserve to pay off the debt that the government incurs when it borrows money from the Federal Reserve Bank. This is all a matter of public record and easily verifiable, should you care to look. The founding fathers of America were well aware of the perils of central banks and sought to prevent them. Several central banks were set up, but then removed. But the ruthless and powerful bankers, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the Warburgs, the Rothschilds, were determined to set up a central banking system in America at any cost. In the early 1920s, J.P. Morgan, one of the most influential bankers of his day, caused massive panic in the markets by spreading rumors that many private banks were about to go bankrupt. This caused widespread panic. Everyone started withdrawing their deposits en masse, and the banks had to call in all of their loans to try and survive. The hysteria destroyed the markets, and the banking elites, having caused the panic, used it to influence politicians and the public that a central bank would bring stability to the system. At a secret meeting in 1910 at the estate of J.P. Morgan on Jekyll Island, the bankers wrote the Federal Reserve Act. They then gave their considerable financial and political support to Woodrow Wilson on the condition he would support the bill if elected. In 1913, Woodrow Wilson signed the bill into law. He later wrote in regret. The bankers made immediate moves to increase and consolidate their power. From 1921 to 1929, the banks drastically increased the money supply, making millions of loans. Then, in October 1929, Having quietly exited the markets, they started calling in those loans en masse. The hysteria that followed led to the Great Depression. The conspiring bankers bought up rival banks and massive corporations for pennies on the dollar. Their position of power and influence had become absolute.
We get almost all of our information from the media. If we base our opinions on bad or biased information, then everything we believe is suspect. Political debate today is kept within very narrow boundaries, so the media can present both sides of these narrow positions and give the impression we have a free press. However, to talk about left or right-wing press is to miss a very important point. Whatever message big business wants carried, with whatever slant, the media will carry that story unfailingly.
Well, the title is actually borrowed from a book by Walter Lippmann, written back around 1921, in which he described what he called the manufacture of consent as a revolution in the practice of democracy. What it amounts to is a technique of control. And he said this was useful and necessary because the common interests, the general concerns of all people, elude the public. The public just isn't up to dealing with them. And they have to be the domain of what he called a specialized class. Notice that that's the opposite of the standard view about democracy. There's a version of this expressed by the highly respected moralist and theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who was very influential on contemporary policymakers. His view was that rationality belongs to the cool observer, but because of the stupidity of the average man, he follows not reason but faith. And this naive faith requires necessary illusion. The point is that in a military state or a feudal state or what we would nowadays call a totalitarian state, it doesn't much matter what people think because you've got a bludgeon over their head and you can control what they do. But when the state loses the bludgeon, when you can't control people by force, and when the voice of the people can be heard, you have this problem. It may make people so curious and so arrogant that they don't have the humility to submit to a civil rule, and therefore you have to control what people think.
And there you go. We're getting into the nuts and bolts of how this society works and how you can change it. That is from the extraordinary film called Ethos, directed by Pete McGrane, featuring Noam Chomsky, Woody Harrelson, Bill Hogan, and Cynthia McKinney, and a great many other people of significance. And what is significant about this film that is available to you for a pledge of $75 for the complete shrink-wrapped DVD set is the idea that WBAI is resonant with the urge for change and ethical, political, economic, military, social procedures around this world. The point I really want to stress to you is that we are not alone. And that goes for us on a meta level, as much as it does on the financial level. WBAI is at the beginning of what would be a great transition for us. We're about to have our new space, but we've got to get through this bridge on troubled money right now. And so, hence we pause for you to give us a call at area code 516-620-3602. I'm going to wait for a half dozen people to join us and take part in the ethics that will sustain this radio station. 516-620-3602. We can do this in 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. It only takes you a couple of minutes to indicate your assent to the continuity of WBAI, ASSENT. So 516-620-3602. I'm Robert Knight here with Michael G. Haskins and Kathy Davis a bit earlier, and I think she'll be joining us later on as well. But let's get those first phone calls coming. Michael G., we were chatting backstage, as it were, about some of the elements of this film, and I know you got very tickled about the next segment we're going to hear.
Yes, I did.
But tell the people about why they need to support us right here at this most urgent of times.
It is a very urgent time for us here at WBAI right now, and it is so important because there are many radio stations out there doing many things, and I know a number of other people are talking about narrowcasting and internet broadcasting, but we broadcast over 3.5 states, parts of Pennsylvania, New York, upstate New York. We don't go all the way upstate New York, but we certainly cover a large swath of New York State and Connecticut and Long Island. We're able to bring you these broadcasts, this kind of programming, simply because we are listener-sponsored, listener-supported, and have been for 53 years. And that's an incredible thing when you stop to think about it, that the listeners have funded this organization for all of those years. And it's gone through many transformations and generations, and now it's going through yet another. And with looking at the potential of having our own space is such a wonderful, wonderful thing for all of us to think about and contemplate. But with your help and through your support, if you call right now, 516-620-3602, and it's only going to take, as Robert said, only a couple of minutes, maybe 3 minutes, to make that call, to make that contribution to support 5 O'Clock Shadow and WBAI. Let's hear from you now, folks.
You know, with my work with John Pilger and other documentarians and historians, there's a name that keeps coming up in the destruction of the ethos of humanity and the governance of money and the profiteering of war. And that is someone who was a cousin of Sigmund Freud and who mastered the manipulation of the collective id. His name is Bernays, and boy, did that man have some sauce. And we're going to soon hear exactly how the avalanche, the cascading conspiracy of media manipulation really got into full tilt, really got into high gear in the United States and soon to be around the world. But we need maybe 4 or 5 more of you to join us. 516-620-3602. We are in the forum of ideas and in the landscape of liberation. And we need you to sustain us to our bright new future coming up in just a few months. 516-620-3602. We are sustaining the transmitter fund, and without being all whiny and detailed about it, I've got to say that the entire staff of WBAI has been contributing in a way that I think for many of us is more painful than your picking up the phone and calling 516-620-3602. And if you are part of that commitment, if you're part of those islands, the thousand islands of freedom that do not fully know the extent to which the others exist, WBAI is that meeting ground of the air. And we are the synergizer of movements of consciousness and liberation. And what you are getting in addition to this thank you gift is the real treasure the maintenance of a medium. That, oh, there's another one. Thank you, Michael.
Just came in right now. Just a couple of moments ago, another call came in. Now there are a few people that have called already. We need you to call now. It's good that call came in. I want to thank that person
yes, if we can.
But look, we need the rest of you now. And certainly, if you've called already, if you've called in March, if you've called in February, then we're really not asking you to make your contribution because you have done so already. You have supported us. But we know there are tens of thousands of you who are listening right now, potentially listening right now, listening to 5 o'clock Shadow, and we're reaching out to you. We're asking for your support. We're asking for you to support this radio station that does so much for all of us, talking about peace and justice. That is what we're talking about, and the end to war profiteering, as Robert said. So we need to hear from you now. 516-620-3602. This is WBAI, commercial free, listener sponsored WBAI, and this is 5 o'clock Shadow with Robert Knight. 516-620-3602.
And as Kathy was saying earlier, we are liberated from the corporations and we are not paid to say things that are false to us or to you.
And just as we were speaking, Robert, just as you spoke, two more calls came in to WBAI this afternoon. So the listeners are out there. They are responding. You know, we're a bit down. We've been punched in the stomach a little bit, but we're coming back. We're drawing that breath. We can come back. We will come back with your support. Time and time again, the listeners are what keeps us going. 516-620-3602. Because the listeners know that they cannot hear this anywhere else. And I'm so proud. Every time I say this, I am proud of the listeners, because you don't have to do it. You don't have to, but you do time and time again. Thank you so much. 516-620-3602. 5 o'clock Shadow with Robert Knight.
Three more of you and we'll move on, because we ain't going to let no temporary happenstance bring us down. 516-620-3602. I woke in the midst of depression and poverty this morning.
Yes. Yes. Depression and poverty, yes.
But like Job and Abraham, the Lord will test your patience. Doggone it, if you have not renewed my faith with your faith in this radio station and the pledge. I think we need maybe two more. At 516-620-3602. We need to have you return the momentum of the community action that makes this community of the air possible. And those of you who have waited, Michael was talking about the tens of thousands of people who have not yet pledged to WBAI and yet who are engrossed by and sometimes grossed out by its presentation. So 516-620-3602, because the latter shall be the greater. The last shall be the greatest, because this is the moment that we need you. Two more calls. 516-620-3602. Area code 516-620-3602. That is our new pledge center. And part of this vision that is pressing upon us within a matter of weeks or months is we will soon, with your permission, be able to have you back in our studios to answer the phones so that we could do it in real time. We're doing it very efficiently now with the call center, but it takes a little bit of a delay for it to be digitized and then transmitted to our recognition of your pledge. Somebody do that now. Let's see how long it takes. 516-620-3602. And can you imagine? It's like the Irish sing, a nation once again, we shall be a station once again. We shall have a unified location for the, you know, you don't need a smartphone. You don't need infrared or Wi-Fi or Bluetooth for carbon-based intellectual machines to share information through proximity. And that is the beautiful vision that stands before us, right on the other side of the raging shark-filled waters of debt and obligation. And we, you see, this may seem like a difficult step or moment today, but it's part of a process of financial liberation from the extraordinary, unique throughout the Pacifica Network rents that we were required to pay after they changed the rules on the nonprofit and market rate at Wall Street. This is us recovering, as the Irish also say, we ourselves, Sinn Féin. And we ourselves have to make up for what, in my opinion, is an inadequate response from an insurance company that used to once sponsor a very intelligent guy on public television. 516-620-3602. Sisters and brothers got to do it for themselves today. One more call. 516-620-3602, and we'll continue with our sampling of this analogous, this parallel film, this DVD called Ethos. It is a mind rocker. It will blow your mind, and you can then become an agent of liberation in the same spirit as Pacifica and the astute analysis of this film, Ethos. 516-620-3602, a pledge of merely $75. And it's, well, yes, you can be an agent of creative subversion and education by having and sharing this DVD. But what you are really paying for is the ability to tune to 99.5 and not hear static. And by static, I mean another sports channel or another right-wing talk channel or another, useless, inhibitory, somnambulistic, narcotizing broadcast entity. There will never be another BAI if you let it go right now. 516-620-3602. Please, please, you, and support your radio station. Maintain its continuity. This is WBAI in New York. I'm Robert Knight. This is a special edition 5 o'clock shadow. I'm here with Kathy Davis and Michael G. Haskins. And they, along with people like Reggie and Esther and Hugh and Andrea and Berthold and everybody else, John and Sean, everybody here at the staff is putting their chest on the barbed wire of the difficulty of this moment. And I, there's enough. That's it. Thank you, Michael G. Such existential courage makes me so damn proud to be a part of this enterprise called WBAI, part of the Pacific Radio Network, and to have friends, sustainers, and people of wisdom and generosity like yourselves listening at this moment. And I promise that we would go deeper into the manipulation of our collective id and hear now the real deal of how we started to get hypnotized in America and around the world.
100 years ago, Sigmund Freud, famous for giving us the science of psychological analysis, suggested that the ideal of individual freedom, central to the idea of democracy, was impossible. He said our hidden desires were too dangerous. Human beings could never be allowed to fully express themselves, that we must always be controlled and would thus always be discontent. Sigmund Freud's American nephew was Edward Bernays. Bernays is almost completely unknown today, but his influence on our society is possibly much greater than Freud. Bernays took the new science developed by his famous uncle and used it to manipulate the masses. Bernays is the man who invented the profession and the term public relations. He worked for most of the major corporations and advised politicians on how to win favor with the public. Like Freud, Bernays was convinced that humans were driven by irrational forces, but by stimulating our inner desires and then sating them with consumer products, he created a new way to manage the irrational behavior of the masses.
What Eddie got from Freud was indeed this idea that there is a lot more going on in human decision making, not only among individuals, but even more importantly among groups, than this idea that information drives behavior. And so Eddie began to formulate this idea that you had to look at things that would play to people's irrational emotions. And you see, that moved Eddie immediately into a different category from other people in his field and most government officials and managers of the day, who thought if you just hit people with all this factual information, they would look at that and say, oh, of course.
There's a psychology of dress. Have you ever thought about it? How it can express your character? You all have interesting characters, but some of them are all hidden. I wonder why you all want to dress always the same, with the same hats and the same coats. I'm sure all of you are interesting and have wonderful things about you, but looking at you in the street, you all look so much the same. And that's why I'm talking to you about the psychology of dress. Try and express yourselves better in your dress.
He had a home in the corner suite of the Sherry Netherland Hotel. And here's this wonderful suite with all these windows looking out on Central Park and across at the plaza and on the square. And he would use this place to hold a soiree. The mayor would come. All the media leaders would come, the political leaders, the business leaders, the people in the arts. I mean, it was a who's who. People wanted to know Eddie Bernays because, you know, he himself became a sort of a famous man, a sort of a magician who could make these things happen.
Eddie Bernays saw the way to sell product was not to sell it to your intellect, that you ought to buy an automobile, but that you will feel better about it if you have this automobile. I think he originated that idea that they weren't just purchasing something, but they were engaging themselves emotionally or personally in the product or service. That it's not you think you need a new piece of clothing, but you'll feel better with the piece of clothing. That was his contribution in a very real sense. We see it all over the place today, but I think he originated the idea of the emotional connect to a product or service.
Democracy, to my father, was a wonderful concept, but I don't think he felt that all those publics out there would had reliable judgment, and that they very easily might vote for the wrong man or want the wrong thing, so that they had to be guided from above. You appeal to their desires and their unrecognized longings, that sort of thing. That you can tap into their deepest desires or their deepest fears and use that to your own purposes.
Many influential thinkers came to believe that the public were incapable of making rational decisions and that as such, democracy could never work. Walter Lippmann, one of the most influential political writers at that time, argued that if people were in reality motivated by irrational forces, then what was needed was control by the elites to manage what he called the bewildered herd. And this could be accomplished by using psychological techniques to control the unconscious desires of the masses.
So here you have Walter Lippmann, probably the most influential political thinker in the United States, who is essentially saying that the basic mechanism of the mass mind is unreason, is irrationality, is animality. He believes that the mob in the street, which is how he sees ordinary people, are people who are driven not by their minds but by their spinal cords. The notion of kind of animal drives, unconscious instinctual drives lurking beneath the surface of civilization. And so they started looking towards psychological science as a way of understanding the mechanisms by which the popular mind works, specifically with the goal of figuring out how to understand how to apply those mechanisms to strategies for social control. Democracy, at its heart, was about changing the relations of power that had governed the world for so long. And Bernays' concept of democracy was one of maintaining the relations of power, even if it meant that one needed to sort of stimulate the psychological lives of the public. So democracy is reduced from something which assumes an active citizenry to the idea of the public as passive consumers. Driven primarily by instinctual or unconscious desires, and that if you can in fact trigger those needs and desires, you can get what you want from them.
The corporations understood that to change our consumer culture from needs-based to desire-based purchasing, people must be trained to want new things even before the old had been consumed.
Bernays really is the guy within the United States more than anybody else who sort of brings to the table psychological theory as something that is an essential part of how, from the corporate side, of how we are going to appeal to the masses.
He showed the corporations how they could make people want things they did not need by linking products to their unconscious desires. And the mass media would be the key.
Wow. If only Bernays I could be. And subliminally manipulate your id into consuming the station in the way that corporations make you consume needless things. If only I could pull the strings of which you are unaware and pick your pocket and transfer that money to WBAI. If only I could, I wouldn't do that because it wouldn't be ethical. And there's no need for subterfuge, because this is a radio station that speaks to the consciousness and conscience of the conscious. And boy, howdy, let me tell you, it's a far better thing. You have been responding in a way that's turning the day around. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And let's see, we need a few more pledges before you get to the top of the hour. We want to be a living example of how, you know, just like the clotting mechanism of blood, at a time of injury, a financial injury to WBAI, you corpuscles will come together and staunch the bleeding and keep the system pumping and provide us with the adrenaline to make the leap over this bridge of transient difficulty to our grand new home. And the extreme agreement that had to be made with the Empire State Building to maintain this most precious transmitter and keep the signal alive. There has never been a radio station at the middle of an FM band with a commercial license from a non-commercial 501c3 entity like Pacifica in the biggest market in the world, also the most expensive one to maintain. And I cannot overemphasize to you that there is no walking back if we lose that facility. And as a result, many of the people here have suffered and yet continue to give, you know, here on the staff side, volunteer side, far above and beyond. And the rage of deprivation did not occur because everyone here, I think, understands the greater need for the community and the community's need for the existence of a public station like WBAI. And the fact that we have collectively all been able this afternoon to convey that idea is something that is both humbling and embiggening. It is something that makes a difficult and challenging enterprise and profession seem to be worthwhile. And thank you, every one of you, who has pledged so far. We're about, maybe a third of the way to what I think would be a proper and fitting response today. So, if you've been listening to, well, Kathy Davis earlier, and me and Michael, since 4 o'clock, you'll see that we are dealing with explosive materials of the mind. And there goes Echelon clicking at me. What do you say? Explosive materials. If you know what Echelon is, you owe it to WBAI to give us a pledge at 516-620-3602. If you know what NRO is,